I used to think that I wanted a Viking funeral when I died. Burning boat, being pushed down the river and all that. And then I learned what a Viking funeral was actually like, and yeah, it is not for me. In fact, there's only one aspect that I think I would enjoy, and that is the copious amounts of food. Specifically, these round loaves of bread, which were baked especially to be burned or buried with the mighty Viking. So thank you to Factor for sponsoring this video as I tell you what a Viking funeral was actually like. This time on Tasting History. So when it comes to the Viking Age, we know far less than we probably would like to know because, for the most part, what we know about them comes from outsiders writing about them, people writing hundreds of years after the end of the Viking Age, and, of course, archaeology. And it's the archaeology that can tell us a bit about what this Viking funeral bread was like. Now, this bread was baked for the purpose of being laid at the side of the deceased, kind of as a little snack on their way to Valhalla. And there was no one way that this bread was made. Different fragments have been found at different burial sites, like the one at Birka in Sweden. And with some amazing technology, they've been able to determine what some of the ingredients in the breads were. Most of them were made up of a combination of different flours that were sifted to be very, very fine, kind of the most expensive flour that you could get. Each loaf was a combination of different flours like barley, oat, wheat, rye, and even ground up peas. And then there was usually some sort of seed, like flax seed, added as well. And then for the liquid, sometimes it was done with water, but more often it was some sort of dairy, like milk or butter or whey or buttermilk, or blood, because baking bread with blood is an excellent way to preserve the blood, and I've actually already made Viking blood bread on the channel before, so I have opted to use buttermilk because it's a lot easier to find than blood, and I've already done it. So for this recipe, what you'll need is 1 cup or 120 grams of rye flour, 1 cup or 120 grams of whole wheat flour, 3 quarters cup or 80 grams of oat flour, 1.5 teaspoons of salt, 2 tablespoons of flaxseed, and 3 quarters cup or 175 milliliters of buttermilk. Now, like I said, this bread was meant to be eaten by the deceased on their journey to the afterlife, very Egyptian. But since I am a living person, I do need something a little bit more substantial, which is why I made a wonderful lunch from today's sponsor, Factor. Factor, which is owned by HelloFresh, delivers chef-crafted, ready-to-eat meals right to your door. They're never frozen, always fresh, and they only take about 2 minutes to make. They're perfect for me because usually after being in the kitchen all day cooking for the show, I don't have the energy to cook anymore and I don't want to do takeout every night, so I can just take one of these Factor meals, pop it in the microwave, and it's ready to eat in a couple minutes. Super flexible. Also flexible are their plans where you can get from 4 to 18 meals per week, and they have an amazing variety. 35 weekly options with meals for everyone, whether you're vegetarian, keto, vegan, or looking for extra protein, like in the Parmesan artichoke and shredded chicken casserole with broccoli, which is a particular favorite of mine. So head to factor75.com or click the link in the description and use my code TASTINGHISTORY50 to get 50% off of your first Factor box, plus 20% off of your next month of orders. That's TastingHistory50 at factor75.com for 50% off of your first box, plus 20% off of your next month of orders. Now, while you can prepare a Factor meal in about 2 minutes, it does take a little bit longer to make some Viking bread, but not as long as you might think, because you'll notice that this was unleavened. I didn't add any leavener into the ingredients, and so it was an unleavened flatbread, which doesn't take that long to make, about 20 minutes from start to finish. All you do is mix your chosen flours together, add in the salt and the flaxseed, and then pour in your buttermilk, and start to work everything together until it forms a dough. What you're looking for is a fairly dry dough. You want it to kind of come together so you can knead it well. Now, usually I only knead bread for maybe like 15 minutes by hand, but because of the low gluten content in these flours, I had to knead this for about 25 minutes before it became smooth enough that I could divide it up into a dozen pieces. Then form the dough into a ball and roll it out into a little pancake a little bigger than the size of your palm. Should be fairly thin, but not as thin as a tortilla, even though these do kind of end up looking like little burnt tortillas. Then you can either bake these out on an open fire, like on a stone, or if you have a kitchen, which most Vikings would not have had a kitchen, but if you have a kitchen, then you can just put a pan, a dry pan, on your stove and cook them on there. So heat it over medium-high heat, then toss on a loaf and let it cook. It only takes about 45 seconds to 1 minute on one side, and then you can flip it. You should see a bit of coloring, maybe even some char on that cooked side, and you'll know that the second side is done when it starts to puff up. Then take it off the heat and let it cool for just a moment before you poke a hole through the middle. I used a chopstick. Now why, you may ask, am I poking holes in my bread? That is because that's how many of the loaves were found in these burial sites. They were found with holes in the center and then strung through on a ring, like this. And they were usually metal, like either iron or some other sort of metal ring. And they're not entirely sure why this was. One theory is that this is how they were hung in daily life, though they would have been hung on a string of like flax or hemp, something cheap. But when you have like a Viking chief, you're not going to just give them a hemp rope. You're going to give them something nice with metal. So that's how you do it. So now that we know how to make this bread, I think we need to take a closer look at the event that the bread was made for, the Viking funeral. The Viking funerals that you see on TV and film are usually a body being put onto a boat and then set out into a river and lit with a fiery arrow of some sort and letting it blaze. And while it's impossible to say that that never happened, it's unlikely that it was at least a common practice because as the ship sank and burned, it wouldn't have burnt everything completely. The water would have extinguished it, and so you'd probably end up with like a half-charred corpse just bobbing along in the water. That's very undignified. But this wasn't completely just made up out of thin air. It is based in some reality. Many a powerful Viking, and I use the word Viking to refer to kind of everybody of the Nordic culture at the period, rather than just meaning the raiders. Many a powerful Viking has been found buried or burnt and buried with a Viking longship. One of the most famous archaeological sites in the Nordic region is the Oseberg Burial Mound. In the center of this site was a well-preserved Viking longship in exquisite condition. Dating from around the first third of the 9th century, it is 70 feet long, nearly 17 feet across, and was fitted with a 30-foot mast and 15 oars on each side. What's interesting is that while this tended to be a male-dominated society, at least amongst their leaders, the people on this boat were actually women. It was two women. One was about 80 years old. The other was considerably younger, either 25 or 30 or 50, depending on what method they used. And they were both dressed in a way that it's kind of hard to tell which had a higher social status. But they were buried with a lot of fancy grave goods. These are the things like the bread and the ale and other food, as well as daily objects meant for the journey to the afterlife, like a highly decorated sleigh, a cart, bedposts, wooden chests, and a bucket with a brass and cloisonné ornament of a man sitting in a position which has earned the artifact the name of the Buddha Bucket. Now, not everybody would get a fancy longship like this for their burial. You had to be pretty important. Even some high-ranking warriors were just buried or burned with their sword and their shield. That was enough for them. But then there was also this kind of like middle tier where you got a longship, kind of. It was made out of stones. Several of these burial sites have been found and are often the resting places of dozens or even hundreds of people. Now, what exactly was happening at these funerals is kind of hard to suss out because, one, they were taking place over many, many years in many, many different places, but also they weren't writing down like exactly what was happening. So we're relying on much later authors who were usually writing in the form of myth or foreign authors who maybe don't exactly understand what they're watching. For instance, the Icelandic poet Snorri Sturluson, who was writing hundreds of years after the end of the Viking Age and was clearly writing myth, he described several funeral practices of the Nordic people. Like in the Prose Edda, he talks about how people needed to have their fingernails and their toenails cut before they were buried because it would stop Naglfar from being constructed. Naglfar being a ship entirely made of the fingernails and toenails of the deceased that was supposed to come ferry different monsters to battle the gods at Ragnarok. No nails, no Ragnarok. He He also describes some of the post-funeral feasts that they would have, and again, they're clearly mythological, but there was probably some basis in reality. Then the funeral feast was held for the Niflungs, and at this feast Gudrun had mead poured into the flagons for King Atli. There was no lack of strong drink there, so that most of the company had fallen asleep where they sat. But what I left out was the definitely mythological part of the flagons being made of Gudrun's own son's skulls, because they didn't drink out of skulls, they drank out of horns and cups, just like regular people. But they did drink a lot at these feasts, so that part is based in reality. Both the funeral ale and the feasts themselves were known as the Thjond, and it tended to take place 7 days after a person had died. While participating in ritual drinking, it was a time for new oaths to be sworn and a time for the heirs to receive their inheritance. But this is something that took place after the funeral, and I want to know what it was like at the Viking funeral. And for that, we really have one well-written source that kind of describes it all happening. But it comes with a lot of caveats. First of all, it's describing a Viking funeral amongst the Rus, who were people who had been Vikings up in Norway and Sweden and had moved south into what is now Russia. It's where we get the name Russia. But it had been about 100 years since they had done that, so it's unclear kind of if their practices had intermingled with those people who were already there. Also, it's written by someone who is foreign and probably doesn't know exactly what he's watching. He didn't speak the language. He did have an interpreter, but we don't know how well that interpretation went. We just don't know. He was from Arabia, and he was a traveler named Ibn Fadlan, and he had gone up there and spent time with these Vikings and wrote down a bunch of stuff about them. He definitely had some biases against them, but he was really interested in what their funeral practices were like, and he finally got to watch one and he wrote them down. So again, we don't know. Maybe this was a one-off. We don't know who got this treatment. We don't know if it was all over the Viking world or just in this one place, but it's the best we got. It's the account of the funeral of a wealthy chieftain, and Fadlan says that after the chief has died, they placed him in his grave, which they covered with a roof, and they left him there for 10 days, waiting while they finished cutting and sewing his garments. They gather his fortune and divide it into 3 portions, one for his household, one for the making of his funeral clothes, and another for the alcohol that they will drink on the day that his slave girl kills herself and is burned with her master. They are addicted to this drink. They drink it night and day, and sometimes one of them dies, cup in hand. Now, exactly what this drink was, he doesn't say. He actually calls it nabid, which is an Arabic drink that at the time was made from like fermented dates or raisins and could be intoxicating, but they wouldn't have had that where he's writing this, so he's probably just saying it's an intoxicating drink. So maybe it was some sort of ale or kvass or mead, who knows, but it was definitely intoxicating. So in addition to the drinking, he says that they are preparing to make him clothes, and that is definitely a practice that was popular up in the Nordic countries around this time as well. And because he's a wealthy man, they are fancy clothes. The finest trousers, leggings, boots, and tunic, and a silk caftan with gold buttons, and a peaked cap covered with sable. And then he mentions the slave girl, and this would have been one of the thralls that belonged to the dead man. And Ibn Fadlan says that the thralls are approached and asked which of them offers to be sacrificed with their master. And invariably, one of them agrees. And once they have spoken, the words are binding and there is no turning back. If they wanted to change their mind, they would not be allowed to. It is usually the girl thralls who offer to die. And lest the girl change her mind, get cold feet about the whole thing, she is put with 2 other girls who watch her day and night and do not leave her side for the next 10 days while the clothes are being prepared. And during this time, the girl, rightly so, drinks, and drinks a lot, and she dances and sings, and according to Fadlan, is very cheerful and happy. Then when the day came that the great man and the female thrall were to be set on fire, I went to the river where his boat was moored. I saw that they had beached his boat, and it was supported by four posts of kadank wood, and a wooden frame had been erected. The boat was hauled up to rest on top of the structure. And then they built a yurt, or sort of tent, on the boat, and inside of that they built a bed. It was just mattresses and some Byzantine silk brocade cushions. And then an old woman comes, who Fadlan says they call the Angel of Death. And she's the one who's in charge of making the bed, she's the one in charge of preparing the funeral clothes, and, as her moniker would suggest, it is she who kills the slave girl. I saw that she was a witch, thick-bodied and sinister. And only when she's arrived do they exhume the body, and they dress it in the clothes, and then they bring it aboard the ship. And around it, they start to lay the grave goods, and first it's food. It's things like the alcohol and meat and onions and basil, he says, is there, and different fruit, and of course, lots of bread. Then come the animal sacrifices. First it's his dogs, then two horses and two cows and two chickens. They're all cut up and thrown up onto the boat. And then the girl arrives. And at this point, I am going to give you a warning, something I don't think I've ever done in a video, so pay attention. If up to this point you have felt squeamish at all or uncomfortable, it's going to get worse. So go to the part of the video where I'm tasting the bread. If you're uncomfortable, skip ahead. The slave girl who wished to be killed came and went, entering one yurt after another. The owner of the yurt would have intercourse with her and say, "Tell your master that I did this out of your love for him." By the evening, the girl came and arrived at the boat, and they put her on something that he says looked like a door frame, and then they lifted her up into the air three times. And the first time, she said that she could see her mother and father who had passed. And then the second time, she said that she could see all of her dead relatives and her ancestors. And the third time they raise her up, she says that she can see paradise itself, and there is her master, and he is calling for her, and she is ready to join him. Then she too goes up onto the boat, and she takes off all of her jewelry, her rings and bracelets, and she gives some of them to the Angel of Death, and then she gives the rest to the two girls who have been with her, who, Ibn Fadlan now tells us, are the daughters of the Angel of Death, angels in training, I guess. And so they take all of her worldly goods, and then she drinks. She drinks a lot. She drinks so much that Fadlan says that she's in a stupor and she can't even walk right, and she has trouble making her way into the tent. But the old woman helps her and she goes into the yurt. Then the men begin to strike their shields with their staves to drown out her cries, so that the other thralls would not be frightened and not wish to die with their masters. Then six men enter the yurt and lie with the girl, and then she lay beside her master. The Angel of Death came and put a rope around her neck and gave the two ends to two men to pull on. Then she advanced with a broad-bladed dagger and began to plunge it between the girl's ribs again and again as the two men strangled her until she was dead. Then the dead man's closest male relative came forward and picked up a stick, which he lit at a fire. He walked backwards, completely naked. He set fire to the wood beneath the boat. The people came forward with sticks alight with fire and threw them upon the wood. The wood caught fire, then the boat, the yurt, the dead man, the girl, and everything else on board caught fire. A fearsome and violent wind began to blow. The flames grew higher and higher and blazed fiercely. While Ibn Fadlan is watching this take place, a Viking near him starts to tell him why they burned and cremated their bodies rather than burying them. And he's actually kind of rude about the whole thing, but he tells him why they do this. "We burn them in the fire in an instant, so that at once and without delay they enter paradise. The wind will come to take him away within an hour." And indeed, not an hour had passed before the ship, wood, girl, and master were no more than ashes and dust. So this story may seem a far cry from food history. You came here for food history, and it is in many ways, but it's not, really. Because what I've found is while I do research on food, I'm always coming across these stories that are so interesting, but are really have nothing to do with it, except that they do, because they're always intertwined. Yes, the food is a bit player, but just as important as it is, as the Viking said, that the chieftain is able to float away on the wind to Valhalla, it's just as important that he has food and drink and sustenance to take with him. And they believe that when he gets to Valhalla, he's going to go to Odin's mead hall and feast with all of the other dead warriors that went before him. And it's one reason that I love food history, because it is integral to all of the stories I end up reading. And it kind of gives that tie to someone who lived so, so long ago. Like, I have nothing in common, really, with a Viking chieftain from the 10th century, except that I do, because I eat. He ate, I eat. And so it's really, really cool that on the show, I can eat what he was actually going to eat, or a version of it. And that is this bread that was made specifically for Viking funerals. Now, I did eat some right when I took it off of the griddle, and it was nice and warm, but now it's been a few minutes, so now it's about room temperature, but still, it's nice and soft. If you bake it longer, it eventually will become more like a cracker, but I wanted it nice and soft, so here we go. Tastes kind of like pita. It's actually really flavorful. The buttermilk was a good idea. And because of all those different flours involved, it's so much more complex. It has a lot more depth than just plain wheat bread. I do think that it would be great with some butter. And they ate a lot of butter. Butter was a big thing in Nordic culture, in Viking culture. Because that was kind of a show of wealth, was having butter. So yeah, I'll probably put some butter on this and try it again later, but everything is better with butter. Now, I am going to include links to both a video that kind of tells more of the narrative of Ibn Fadlan's time with the Vikings, as well as a link to all of his writings on the subject that you can go read. It's really, really interesting. But it's, you know, some of it's a little bit graphic, like I said. But this is the kind of stuff that you'll get if you sign up for the Tasting History newsletter by visiting tastinghistory.com. Extra little things that I come across while doing research for different videos. And yeah, I have lots more Viking videos, so I'll put a playlist to those if you haven't seen them. And I will see you next time on Tasting History.